thanks for joining us. Very recently, the new administration of the country has formalized the whole notion of climate change by incorporating it into a climate change ministry. And because of this, we're looking at some policies and actions that is not just taken from the government, but from the private sector as well. Joining me in the studio, joining us from Singapore, is Dr. Robert Judd. He is, of course, the Technical Director of Hydrogen and Gas of APEC at DNV. DNV is a global or leading assurer of risk assessment in terms of energy transition. Rob, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. Let's, in your own words, perhaps you can explain to us what DNV is and what do you guys stand for?
Well, DNV is the leading classification society in the world, the global classification society. It's been around since 1864. It's active across a number of different sectors, including maritime, digital, energy, business assurance, etc. We have a purpose which is stated as to safeguard life, property, and the environment. And our vision is that we will be a trusted voice to tackle global transformations. And of course, within energy, that transformation is very much upon us, and it is going to be upon us for many years into the future. And we are within, globally, we are the biggest source of or resource of energy experts and technical advisors. Mm. So we are looking globally to support clients, and we have many across many sectors, support those clients in meeting the aims of the Paris Agreement. That's to limit, as far as possible, the global temperature rise from 1990 to 2050. To 1.5 degrees, which is a major challenge. You may be aware of our Energy Transition Outlook report, which we issue every year, the last one being in October, which is produced from our headquarters in Norway. And a huge modelling exercise, which divides the globe into 10 regions and looks globally and regionally at what the likely trajectories are in terms of forecasting the future of energy between now and 2050. As I say, 10 separate regions, four of which are in APAC. A huge amount of information goes into that model in terms of current activities, current policies, current technology trajectories, roadmaps, commitments, understanding of how technologies will develop. That goes into a model which looks at supply and demand, likely outputs and forecasts one route. It doesn't look at scenarios, it looks at what is most likely to happen between now and 2050. Mm-hmm. And this is something that we issue every year. We put it on our website. It's there for everyone to download and look at. And we believe that forecast can actually inform people, inform customers, inform the public, inform everyone about what is likely to happen, what we believe is likely to happen between now and 2050, and most importantly, really, to consider perhaps what needs to be done to change that trajectory if it's not going where it needs to go. And currently, it's safe to say that we need to do more. And this year, within that Energy Transition Outlook, we've also included what we see as a pathway to net zero. And of course, the intention behind the Paris Agreement is that by 2050, we reach what's called net zero with regard to CO2 emissions. So effectively, there will be emissions will effectively not have reached zero, but in terms of inputs and outputs, we will no longer be emitting net CO2 or carbon or greenhouse gases.
I'm trying to pull back into the kind of experience or the background that you're having right now, because mm-hmm. The development of some European industries and companies and part of your work is into the transition of biomethane, hydrogen, as well as carbon management. Do you feel that kind of experience is important for you to roll out or deploy some of the solutions here in this part of the world?
Definitely. I come from a background of working with the European energy industry, the European gas industry, and you may be aware that there is a very clear route to net zero defined within European policy and at sort of national level within Europe. There are a lot of measures, joined up policy measures, from sort of technical push all the way through to demand pull. There are mandates for use of renewables. There are preferential policies that encourage the use of renewables, encourage the use of biomethane. Of course, these rules are always changing and being adopted, but there's a lot that's happening in Europe which needs to be transferred to the APAC region, not just Europe. I think it's fair to say that everybody's in a different place, and it's important to realise that we can't all go down the same road. And when we start to explore the APAC region, even the APAC region is very, very, very diverse. And of course, when we look at the four different sort of regions in the energy transition outlook within APAC, we have China, the Indian subcontinent, the OECD Pacific, which includes sort of higher GDP nations, and then Southeast Asia, which again is very diverse. And I think what we need to do is to make sure that we can apply the kind of lessons learned in Europe as and when they can be applied, and ensure that we have what's called a just transition. The issues of sustainability and affordability and security
just
of supply.
Like, yeah. Justice as in equality?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, justice in that you need to take people with you. You can't impose a transition on people when it's not affordable.
Everybody in a different place, everybody has a different starting position, has always been the case, not just in Europe, but of course in Southeast Asia and Asia-Pacific at large. Anything that we want to roll out when it comes to, you know, global impact, including, say, for instance, mobility of workers or labor laws, something like that. You always have different countries ahead of other countries, for instance.
Yeah.
How does that differ when it comes to energy transition or energy policy and laws? You know, I would assume that Singapore would have a little bit more advanced, say, energy policy compared to countries like Malaysia, and of course Malaysia would be slightly more advanced than other countries. Because of these different starting positions, how do you want to, or how do you see solutions being deployed across these various markets, considering that we have different starting positions?
That's a very interesting question, and a very good question, and it's a very difficult question to answer because of the diversity of policy and regulations. And as you say, I think Singapore is kind of, in some ways, ahead of the game, but is in a very unique position in that it doesn't have a significant amount of its own resources to do the transformation. So it has to rely on both importing energy and importing the kind of resources, importing, for example, renewable energy from across Southeast Asia and further beyond through interconnections. It has to rely on being able to import. Will rely on importing hydrogen, for example, into its power generation and its sort of maritime and industrial sectors in the next 30 or 40 years. It does have a clear strategy to do that. It's clear that in order to make these things happen, you do need more policy signals. As I said earlier, you need very joined up policy signals. You need to ensure that, again, that although the energy transition is in the long term affordable, there are needs to actually both transfer technology and transfer knowledge and transfer funds in the short term. And that means that the intervention of organizations such as the Asian Development Bank and the Just Energy Transition Fund that we're seeing in Indonesia would then enable those kind of frameworks, regulatory frameworks, that kind of mobilization of resources to happen. Unless there is that kind of support, then unfortunately what you tend to see is business as usual, and then we're relying on the cost trajectories of the technologies themselves and the ability or inability to implement them. And of course there is a huge reliance on coal, for example, in many parts of Asia, and Indonesia and China are very heavily reliant on coal at the moment for power generation. But at the same time, the cost of renewables is potentially falling below the cost of traditional power generation, but that doesn't necessarily mean the transition will happen, because you have to integrate those renewables into the system, which of course requires both infrastructure development, it requires regulation and policy, but it also requires the people and the training and the skills. So we have to provide all those things in order to make things happen.
Some of the industries would require heavy investment from, you know, very ambitious investors from PE level, maybe the way we see in Norway, for instance, or an extremely aggressive government who is committed to doing this, say, for instance, in Singapore. in Malaysia, we're just trying to get a grasp in terms of how we can move into cleaner technology and cleaner energy as well.
Yeah.
As evidenced by the creation of a climate change ministry only 3 months ago. That's the crazy bit.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, we've seen bits and pieces by, say, for instance, government as well as private industries in terms of trying to adopt cleaner technology. How do you see Malaysia rolling out this, considering that only now that we're starting to get a grasp in terms of how to transition to clean energy at a policy level?
Again, that's a very difficult question. And again, it relates to the fact that we cannot do the energy transition as individual countries. We can't make all the moves needed in isolation. And it requires much more of a regional and global level of cooperation and an understanding of where regulations and policies can be rolled out, not just where and how and when. Well, where, how and when are very important considerations. But things like sort of inter-regional energy sort of emissions trading schemes, for example, and carbon taxation are all very, very important steps along the way. But I think the realization is that there is, you know, what we're doing is we're moving through a phase which is a bridge, which is perhaps a difficult one. And understanding how to get onto that bridge is the hard part. Once you're on the bridge and the implementation of the potential is put into place, then the other side of the bridge, actually, we are in a lower cost. In terms of percentage of GDP, 2050 and net zero will actually cost us less in terms of energy investments than we are seeing now. In fact, we would like to go down from sort of 3.5% of GDP to 2.5% of GDP, and there's a move to a more sort of OPEX-driven economy, fuel economy, where you have to pay for the fuel and the prices are very unsure and variable. And we've seen what's happened with natural gas in the last year and the prices that Europe is now paying for natural gas, and that's, you know, the war in Ukraine, geopolitical changes can have very severe impacts on the energy system and the price of energy. When we move from that kind of fossil fuel driven system to a renewable based system, which is much more about CapEx and maintaining CapEx rather than OpEx, then there is more certainty. And I think if we can actually plan a roadmap through this that allows us to understand how to get across that bridge to the other side. Mm. The other side is a great benefit because the potential in this region, for example, for renewables is huge. I mean, it's untapped. Our energy transition outlook shows that, power generation, for example, which is currently in Southeast Asia, is 80% fossil fuel, 20% renewable. I mean, 20% is pretty good,
mm-hmm.
But by 2050, it will be 10% fossil fuel and 90% renewable. So that is based on the fact that there are huge falls in the cost of renewables. There will be interconnectors, and it's that infrastructure element which, of course, needs to be kind of rolled out on a regional basis. And that, again, it's not that Malaysia can do that on its own, because it needs to understand how it's going to work alongside its neighbours.
The thing about energy transition is that nobody can argue against the upside of it. However, getting the job done has always been the problem.
Yeah.
In my previous conversation with the EU Commissioner of Environment, I was talking to him in the sense of his work being very futile. He attends COP 25, 26, 27, perhaps COP 50, COP 100 even, and nothing gets done. Mm-hmm. And he is engaging various governments, especially in Malaysia, because the EU has some sort of a perceived notion that Malaysia is not clean when it comes to, say, for instance, some industries like plantation, specifically palm oil or oil palm. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that whole notion of this being a very futile effort in terms of transitioning needs to be shaken off? If so, how? How do we get things done when it comes to energy transition?
I don't think it's futile. I think it's not easy. But I recall, I think the same discussion, there was some discussion around the carbon border adjustment mechanism that the European Union is putting in place, which I think is going to drive change. And I think it's already driving change. I mean, talking about Malaysia, because of course there are the issue of sustainability and the carbon intensity of all products which are being produced and exported to Europe, I think, will become a driver for change.
Mm.
And that also, you know, with kind of carbon taxation frameworks, which are moving into place and will need to move into place and will need to get up to the level where Some parts of the world are at $100 a ton of CO2, and others are sort of much lower, and this part of the world tend to be much lower, but rising. I think the carbon border adjustment mechanism and the difficulty of exporting to Europe without suffering tariffs because of the carbon intensity of products will lead to change, because otherwise competitiveness will disappear, and the need to be able to continue to export, whether it's palm oil or whether it's energy-related, energy-intensive products, I think will drive change from the middle of this decade. Mm-hmm. I think Europe, of course, is looking to ensure that there isn't carbon leakage, because, of course, they can do everything they can to reach net zero. But if people elsewhere in the world are producing energy which is not clean and producing products which are not sustainable, then there's not much point in Europe doing it. You can't do this alone, and no part of the world can do it alone. I don't think it's futile. It's not easy. And I think the messaging is getting out there that globally we are very connected.
We are. However, there are some situations that arise, especially last year on February 23rd when Russia invaded Ukraine, that has created an impetus for many, in fact all European countries, to start thinking about ways of diversifying their energy source. Russia, in turn, surprisingly enough, has been able to sell their output to countries, world countries, you wouldn't argue, in that sense. And they have increased their revenue as well, because they have figured, you know, they don't really need Europe as a client. It's strange that a war is creating an impetus of change of energy behavior. Do you feel that you need some kind of dramatic impetuses like that in order for countries to actually adopt change on energy transition?
Yes and no. I mean,
it's
true that the invasion of Ukraine by Russia did cause a big rethink at European level and an increase in the pace of change. I mean, the hydrogen space, which in terms of importation of hydrogen from sort of global resources, whereas prior to that the expectation was we could actually have a relatively slow trajectory, which was based on production in Europe of green hydrogen and blue hydrogen, CCS. Mm. Now there is much more focus on imports, and there's much more focus on security. But my feeling is that although that is having a relatively short-term effect in terms of the economy, the energy economy, I think the long-term effect is still going to be based on the need to achieve that 1.5 degrees, because I think when the implications of not achieving it become more apparent, and I think they're starting to become apparent in terms of the cost of the kind of increased incidence of extreme weather. I mean, we are seeing costs, and I think there's a greater acceptance that the cost will be higher, the cost of not doing something will be much higher than the cost of doing something. I think those are the kind of messages and signals which will lead to change. But just going back to the war in Ukraine, I think, you know, what that I think tells the world is that although one day you might be going along quite happily thinking that we're moving along in a direction that makes us secure, the whole issue of security of supply can change very quickly if geopolitics change and someone in somewhere else, maybe in this part of the world, decides to adopt a similar stance to what Russia is doing. And that is always a possibility. Yeah. So, you know, it could happen anywhere in the world. And that is, I think, a lesson that we need to learn from what's happened in Russia, because, you know, the volatility of energy prices, which is was already in place to some extent due to COVID and the outputs of the pandemic, the lack of gas in storage, for example, the kind of delayed maintenance that was caused by the pandemic, all those things were kind of multiplied manyfold when Russia invaded Ukraine. And the price volatility is something that I think we can avoid if we move to a more renewable-based system, a system where there is a relatively more local control over energy, more energy security, which, you know, the sun is going to shine, the wind is going to blow. It might not blow every day, but you need to put in place the technologies to ensure that you can store that and use it, and things like battery energy storage and hydrogen and other technologies that are being developed will help us do that. And pushing the development of those technologies, whether at European level or at APAC level, is a very important driver to ensure the prices come down, to make this, not just in the long term, more sustainable, but in the short term, more affordable.
energy transition has been at the forefront of my consciousness because I am a diver, and when I went to when I started diving, there were beautiful corals just around Malaysia. Now there's called coral bleaching everywhere in the globe, not just in Malaysia, and I freaked out, honestly. And you know, you see these beautiful landscape that is now gone. Perhaps permanently at a global scale. And I have been speaking about trying to move forward on energy transition and adopting cleaner technology, not just to, you know, the people around me in my circle, but, you know, to my children, for instance, friends. And the problem here is that I feel that the upside is so huge that the world's first trillionaire is going to come from this industry. That's how crazy I think this situation is. And I think that if somebody can crack the code, as you rightfully put it, it's not futile, but it is difficult. If somebody can crack this code, this person or this individual or this company can actually move forward in terms of being, you know, quite rich in terms of trying to solve this. Where do you see a potential solution is going to come from? What kind of industry that is going to be rolling out first? What kind of countries that is going to have the best policy moving forward on this?
I think the issue with climate change is there are so many pieces of the jigsaw in order to make this happen, and the energy future is going to be much more complex than the energy past, and that means that there will be a lot more...
It's not complicated enough.
There's a lot more... data and data management and the ability to manage and control that data and control how people use energy and consume energy and supply and energy is supplied, I think will be at the forefront of making that happen. It's a future where there will be many options. And if I could predict who was going to get rich, I'd be getting rich right now. But it's a very difficult one, and I don't think there is any one magic bullet, because, as I say, there are many different starting points around the world. That there are technologies that are coming through at the moment, which are decarbonizing electricity is just one element of this, and that I think is well underway at European level. It's well underway. It is starting to happen in this part of the world. It's happening in China, where they're rolling out more renewable power generation than they are coal-fired power generation. We've reached the peak. There are lots of technologies coming through. There are technologies relating to the introduction of hydrogen, which will be able to sort of decarbonize the hard to abate sectors like industry and heavy duty transport and the maritime and potentially the aviation industries. All of these have the potential for that technology, which could be the key. Carbon capture is an area of technology which is going to be vital in reaching net zero, and there are many, many different options for carbon capture, and it may be that we haven't seen the best one. There, somewhere in a lab, somewhere in this part of the world, there may be someone working on a solution which is actually going to allow us to, in a much more efficient way, directly capture carbon dioxide from the air. That direct capture technology is going to be very important. It's already happening, but it's very expensive and very inefficient. But if you could actually make that work better, then that would be a technology which would have, you know, major economic impacts, economic benefits. There are many, and I do agree that this area of decarbonisation is likely to make people rich. We are seeing huge investments in these areas. I mean, you mentioned biomethane. I mean, there are many oil and gas majors now who are investing heavily in biomethane around the world. There are mandates for the introduction of biomethane into gas networks in Europe and elsewhere. I saw a headline yesterday which suggested that clean technology has now reached the $1 trillion mark. That's the same level of investment as we've seen in sort of level investment levels with fossil fuel. So clearly someone sees the potential. And if we're seeing those levels of investment and we're seeing those levels of government support through things like, you know, the Asian Development Bank in this part of the world and the Just Energy Transition Fund in Indonesia, these indicate that there is a real impetus to invest and make these things happen. So it's not just about cost, it's actually, as you say, about the return, and I think the returns are significant.
I have a theory that we need some sort of a quadruple helix model in order for this to happen, the quad being government, i.e. policy and framework, private institutions, both entrepreneurs and investors, media and any form of broadcast to inform the public, and academia, especially when it comes to industries as big and as critical as energy. Do you feel that there would be an idea here to be built on when it comes to this quadruple helix solution when it comes to rolling out this at a, let's say, regional market like ASEAN?
Yeah, definitely. I think the future is a mixture of measures, and I think informing the public is the first one and has to continue. I mean, even again, European level, we are moving towards net zero in a way. You know, we think we've reached the peak emissions, and emissions are falling. There is still perhaps a lack of joined up knowledge at a public level, and I think the perils of climate change are very clear, but I think the road to achieve those benefits is less clear, and the complexity of achieving that is less clear. And I think communicating that level of importance, but also the fact that we all need to if we all sort of change our behaviour a little bit, then we can perhaps move a lot closer. And we if we all understand how we can all make a difference, we can move a lot closer. And I think public knowledge underlies all this, but at the same time, I think the carrot and stick approach to ensuring that things are happening, which can take the public along with it, because if you're telling people they have to pay more tax on products with carbon in or their energy, then they're not likely to agree with that unless they see the consequences and the cost further down the line of not doing it. And if those consequences are a long way off, then people naturally, you tend to disassociate a little from the future because your concerns are more with the now. So I think that communication is really, really important. And as I say, an understanding of the fact that all industries and every individual has a part to play. And I don't think we're in that place yet where these issues are being communicated in a way that they need to be. We hear a lot about what might be happening in 2050 with regard to climate change. You mentioned the bleaching of the coral, but there is a lot more that is happening, a lot more damage that will be done. We are not going to reach net zero. We're not going to reach 1.5 degrees unless, according to our forecast, unless we do a lot more and bring in a lot more both policy, regulation, and technology changes.
To be honest, Rob. You're making me nervous. You're giving me heart palpitations when it comes to the outlook.
Well, no, I'm trying not to. I'm trying to say that we can do more. We are on a trajectory to say 2.2 degrees by 2050, but if people are more aware and if people can then contribute and understand how they can contribute to making this happen, I think we have a chance to change things, but we need to do it quite quickly. We can't just say, let's do it in 2030. We're 25 years away. You know, there will still be a lot of oil and gas in the energy mix in 2050, and it will be serving a purpose. We'll need more carbon capture. We'll need to do it, but we need to accelerate what we're doing, and we can't do that without taking people along with us.
Fantastic. Thanks, Rob, for scaring us. But of course, this is a very much important jolt that is needed, of course. Yep. If you want to learn more, head off to dnv.com. They're a good company to look at, especially on their energy transition report. Also, if you want to learn more about the coral bleaching story, just go to chasingcoral.com. It's on Netflix. You can learn more about that as well. My name is Ibrahim Sani. Continue to stay with us on Astro Awani.